From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. First of all, happy birthday to longtime Coast to Coast listener Tim from Los Angeles, listening, of course, on KFI AM 640. He listens religiously. I don't think he's missed a show in 10 or 15 years. Later, what's going on underground with Richard Sauter? Get ready for that. Should be a classic Coast to Coast show. Here's what's happening. The FBI says it's investigating whether Unabomber Ted Kaczynski was involved in the 1982 Chicago area Tylenol poisonings case that killed seven people. You remember that? Kaczynski wrote in court papers filed in federal court in California last week that prison officials conveyed a request from the FBI for DNA samples. A spokesperson for the FBI said the agency has asked for his DNA. They say that he has refused to voluntarily give a sample, but they've declined whether to say the agency could compel him to provide one. Seven people who took cyanide-laced Tylenol in Chicago and four suburbs died in the space of 3 days back in 1982. That triggered a national scare, prompting an untold number of people to simply toss their medicine away and stores nationwide pull Tylenol from the shelves. The poisonings led to the introduction of the tamper-proof packaging that is now standard. No one was ever charged with the killing of the seven people who died. The one-time suspect, James Lewis, served more than 12 years in prison for trying to extort $1 million from the painkillers manufacturers. Ted Kaczynski is now 68 years old. He's serving a life sentence without the possibility of parole after pleading guilty in 1998 to setting 16 explosions that killed three people and injured 23 others in various parts of the country. His attorney says he thinks the FBI is trying to exclude Kaczynski as a suspect, and that's why they want the DNA. In Florida, a 16-year-old suicide on April 8th is raising questions about what happened one day after his principal, Dr. George Kenny, hypnotized him. A student there says they're blaming him for his death, and all the kids like the principal. They say he tries to help the students. The Sarasota school district officials say that the principal is on paid administrative leave while it investigates. Again, the students support heavily the principal. Dr. Bruce Goldberg is an expert in hypnotherapy. He practices in Los Angeles. Bruce, first of all, I'm not saying that Dr. George Kenny did anything wrong at all trying to help the student with hypnotism, but can a student do something weird after he's been hypnotized?
Well, first of all, the parents gave him permission to use hypnosis, Wesley McKinley, so it wasn't done in secret.
Okay.
Secondly, I've worked with several thousand students as far as exams and what he was working with people like athletic performance and athletes, and it's perfectly safe. I've done this for 37 years. And I've worked with people who go into natural level. Hypnosis is all natural. It's a daydream level. It would be equivalent by saying you had a daydream yesterday by driving in the freeway and not realizing all the exits you went by. Now you want to commit suicide. No, obviously this Wesley McKinney was very severely depressed, and depressive people are the ones who commit suicide. In 150 years of scientific research, there has never been any evidence whatsoever, and we're talking about Johns Hopkins University, Stanford, Harvard University, and others around the world. There's no evidence that hypnosis itself weakens the will, damages the nervous system, or in any way adversely affects the physical, mental, or spiritual being of the individual, nor can you violate their moral or ethical code. If that was the case, then every hypnosis clinic in the world would be 100% successful, and nobody would have any problems. They'd be walking on water. So this is really a ridiculous case, because people understand that hypnosis is not a power or an external force which can be used to influence or coerce. It's simply a natural daydream, what we call an alpha brainwave level. The trance itself is actually the result of the subject's willingness to be hypnotized. You have to allow that. It's not the result of the hypnotist's power.
Dr. Goldberg's website, part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. He's an expert in hypnosis and reincarnation. A security flaw discovered in Google's Android operating system is now being fixed for all users. The flaw was brought to light by a team of German researchers. They posted a paper explaining how certain Google account authentication tokens were being sent over the air in unencrypted, potentially putting users at risk if they are transmitting data over public Wi-Fi networks. You don't have to do anything about it. It's going to be sent to you automatically. Not to worry. Residents along the Gulf and East Coasts could expect an above-average Atlantic hurricane season. Between 12 to 18 named storms are likely during the season that typically runs from June 1st to November 30th. Japan's March 11th megaquake shifted the ocean floor sideways by more than 65 feet, lifted it up by more than 10 feet, according to one instrument placed on the seabed off Japan's coast. The figure was recorded by Japan's Coast Guard, which maintains underwater equipment along the fault responsible for the giant quake. Small amounts of radioactive substances have been detected in the breast milk of five women in Japan now, all of them living from Tokyo all the way down near the plant. Frustrated by stalled Middle East peace talks, President Barack Obama jolted close ally Israel by embracing the Palestinians' terms for drawing the borders of their new nation. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel rejected the idea as indefensible on the eve of his vital White House meeting with the president. The president said that an independent Palestine should be based on 1967 borders before the Six-Day War, in which Israel occupied East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and Gaza, as adjusted by possible land swaps agreed upon by both sides. He said Israel can never live in true peace as a Jewish state if it insists on permanent occupation. Dr. John Curtis, online columnist with us. John, this is a major story. It's beginning to get major play throughout the media, and it's also, before an election, a pretty aggressive move by the president, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I think it's an aggressive move to shoot himself in the foot. It's the worst political move he could possibly make. He's riding high on the bin Laden killing and, you know, antagonizing the American Public Affairs Jewish Committee and most of the conservative population. He's really handing the Republican Party a free Christmas gift right now and kind of energizing the base.
Romney says that the president basically threw Israel under the bus.
Well, the reality of the situation, George, is that the Republicans are going to capitalize on this for political purposes. What Obama is trying to do is to offer a carrot to the Palestinians. He knows that Israel and the U.S. are virtually inseparable as allies. And so to simply go down the middle with impartiality doesn't work with the Palestinians. In order to get them back to the table, he has to offer them something that would appear objectionable to the Israelis. But in private circles, they know that those borders will never be with a new Palestinian state returning to the 67 borders, because there's over 300,000 refugees living in the Jewish refugees living in the West Bank right now, and there's no place to put them in Israel, so they will have to be included in a future Palestinian state. So those borders that Obama is proposing is simply I won't call it a ruse exactly, but it is an opportunity for the Palestinians to, which are in a process of unifying between Hamas and the West Bank-based Fatah with Mahmoud Abbas. They're trying to present a opportunity for them to come to the peace table. So that's what this is about.
When are they going to admit Israel's right to exist and the fact that it is now a nation?
Well, I think the Palestinian Authority, the West Bank group, has admitted that. The Gaza group that seized control of that area in 2007, I believe it was, is controlled by Hamas, has not recognized Israel's right to exist. So as a precondition for any kind of negotiation, Israel will require of Hamas a public statement that they now recognize UN Resolution 242 and Israel's right to exist.
All right, thanks. Dr. John Curtis, website onlinecolumnist.com. Something needs to be done to help the Palestinians, no doubt. But going back to the 67 borders, I don't think is realistic at this point anymore. Theological doomsayers have been trying to convince innocent people for years that the end of the world is near. And a new theory that we've been talking about now, that Judgment Day is coming this Saturday, has certainly generated lots of media attention, but done little to convince many Americans, including most evangelical Christians. Some of those skeptical of the prophecy are planning on celebrating Saturday with tongue-in-cheek rapture parties. Maybe you're going to one. The theory that the rapture or Judgment Day will occur on May 21st appears to have originated with the 89-year-old leader of the Ministry of Family Radio Worldwide, Harold Camping, who earlier predicted the ends of days on September 6, 1994. He was wrong. What will happen on this one? Tomorrow night on Coast to Coast AM, we'll have several guests for you as we lead into May 21st and see if anybody gets taken. We shall see. And enterprising atheist animal lovers are cashing in on religious pet owners who believe the world is about to end on May 21st. They've set up a company called Eternal Earthbound Pets, and they are charging those who think they're going to be taken money so that they can come and take care of their pets for them while they're gone. So far, they have 259 clients who have paid $135 for the first pet, $20 for each additional pet. I'm predicting we'll still be here. There will be no major earthquake on Saturday. This planet has earthquakes all the time. That's not unusual. But anybody, are you going to be around? I don't think you're going to be taken. Not yet, anyway. Here's what some people heard, July 1947, in Roswell, New Mexico.
Headline edition, July 8, 1947. The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army. Army officers say the missile, found sometime last week, has been inspected at Roswell, New Mexico, and sent to Wright Field, Ohio, for further inspection.
Well, what was it? Well, a new book on Area 51 that's already generating a lot of buzz says there was no alien spacecraft that crashed in Roswell, New Mexico in 1947. Instead, the Soviets did it. In the book called Area 51, the spaceship, they say, was actually a Soviet spy plane that came down during a storm. The author claims it was filled with bizarre-looking, genetically engineered, child-sized pilots. Then Soviet leader Joseph Stalin was hoping that the news would cause widespread panic in the U.S. Well, Area 51 has been something we have talked about for years on this program. And up next, we're going to be talking about Area 51 Declassified, an uncensored history of America's top secret military base. Up next, T.D. Barnes, who worked at Area 51, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Now, for years, we have talked about Area 51, and we've had people who claim that they've seen very strange things happening there. This hour, we're going to talk with T.D. Barnes, who worked at Area 51, was cleared at both Q and top secret security levels, operating under a code name and serving as a cadre for ultra-secret projects, most of which remain classified to this day. T.D.'s pre-flight work on the spy planes was figuring out how they would perform against an enemy. His specialty was jamming techniques. Barnes played an important part as well in taking part and apart, putting back together the first Soviet MiG plane ever acquired by the U.S. He's the president of the Roadrunners. It's a group of men who worked and lived at Area 51. Here's T.D. Barnes on Coast to Coast. T.D., welcome.
Good evening, George.
My pleasure. And I understand also National Geographic doing a major program on Area 51 on Sunday night, right?
Yeah, they did it. We went to the premiere screening of it last night. They did a great job on this. It's something that's on the National Geographic Channel, and it comes on at 10 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. And I'm sure everybody will want to see this, because it does answer a lot of questions.
As long as the rapture doesn't hit us on Saturday and take everybody away.
Yeah, I heard that.
There we go. Anyway, tell me a little bit about Area 51, T.D., and your involvement with that area.
Well, it started out for the U-2 plane in 1955. We needed to develop the spy plane to see what the heck was going on in Russia. We, you know, the Iron Curtain It hadn't been put up yet, but they'd closed their borders, and we just frankly were scared to death of what was going on. We was in an arms race, was in getting into the nuclear field and this sort of thing, and we didn't know what our enemy was doing, so we decided to build a spy plane. Lockheed got the contract, and the government decided the CIA should be the one to do it because they the Air Force, one problem with the Air Force was they rotate their people, you know, every 2 or 3 years. They're not permanent, whereas the CIA, you could work there an entire career if you wanted to. So anyway, the CIA built the U-2 spy plane, had Lockheed build it, and it was quite an engineering feat. We built it, and from the day they signed the contract to the first flight was 10 months, and we were $30 million under budget. And that's unheard of today.
It sure is. Now, the area of Area 51, it's in southern Nevada now.
Yes.
Right? And how many areas of that section are underground?
None. They're absolutely in the Groom Lake area, at least at that time, there was absolutely none. In fact, it was very barren. We didn't even have a water well or we moved in some trailers to stay in. It's just very, very primitive.
And I had heard the workers would get flown in from different areas. They'd work there for a while, then they'd be flown out again.
Yeah, this is true. Initially, anyone working out there other than the CIA security people and the communications people, which was just a handful, and later on my team, we were 23 of us in these special projects. We were cadre out there. We were the only ones that were allowed to live in the state of Nevada. Anyone else doing anything had to live out of state.
Who opens it? Who controls it?
It was controlled at that time. It was the CIA from 1955 up to 1979.
All right. So it was really clandestine.
Yes, very, very much so. We developed the U-2 plane, and it left the base about 57, and the 57, and the bases actually became just a dusty camp, and they're still exploding atomic bombs within 8 miles of the base, and they would evacuate the people as they exploded the bombs when they're that close. And as soon as the fallout cloud moved over the base, we'd come back in and go back to work, dust everything off, and if it shattered any windows or anything like that, fix them, and it was thought nothing of it.
Why do they call it Area 51, TDB? It makes you think that there's an Area 50 somewhere or 49.
Well, I think that comes from a designation on the map. But frankly, George, back then, we didn't call it Area 51. Initially, it was called Watertown. That was the because that was the name of the town the CIA director was from in New York. And then when the A-12 people moved in, when we moved in with it, it became the Paradise Ranch. That was Kelly Johnson's joke for making it sound like it was something that it was real desirable to work at. But we just didn't call it Area 51. In fact, no one really knew it existed. It wasn't talked about at all until actually the Air Force took over. And that's when the word started getting out and that there was a base there.
Was it built in secrecy?
Not really. Not as much as you think. It was publicized in the, I know Channel 8 run it. The RV Review Journal had an article on it. And initially, the base wasn't so secret. It was just what was going on there was secret. And later on, they did, kind of clamped down, but we had a softball team that was named the 51s. We'd advertise in newsletters and stuff that the 51s were playing the guys over on the atomic side, atomic bomb side, and it wasn't that big a secret in that respect.
When the workers would come and go, TD, were they checked? Did anybody search them or anything like that?
Not physical searches. We all wore security badges and was on a manifest, and the security was very tight. You didn't get in there unless they knew exactly who you were. And, of course, there wasn't that many people at that time. It was pretty easy to keep track of who all was there. But you were checked before you left the, like if you were leaving out of Burbank or someplace, you'd have someone checking the manifest that you couldn't get on the plane unless your name was on the list, and you had to have your badge. And then when you got on the other end, the security, CIA security would meet you at the plane, and they'd check you when you got off the plane.
All right, hold on, TD. We're going to come back and talk more about Area 51. I've got to ask you about ETs and UFOs and other things. We'll be back. Well, next hour, Richard Sauter joins us as we talk about underwater and underground bases. Richard C. Hoagland, our science advisor and head of the EnterpriseMission.com, sent me an email just moments ago, and others are doing this now, too, about an apparent 8.4 magnitude earthquake off of Libya, reporting that the European Mediterranean Seismological Center is reporting this. Now, the problem is the USGS doesn't show anything, and that normally is instant. This is weird. I have no idea what's going on there. We'll be back in a moment. More with T.D. Barnes as we talk about Area 51 on Coast to Coast AM. Or with T.D. Barnes. T.D., when you got paid, was it a government check, a private check? How'd you get paid?
We got a private check. The CIA was paying for everything. Everybody worked for the CIA, but most of us got private checks, and the money came through the CIA. Even the Air Force was, you might say, paramilitary during that interval of time.
Now, who's running the show now?
It's mostly Air Force.
Mostly.
It's always been kind of a mix. It depends on the project going on. For example, when we was doing the Soviet MiGs, the kill ratio against us in Vietnam was 9-1 against us, and we didn't know why. And we got our hands on a MiG-21, a couple of MiG-17s. We tore them apart to see what made them work, and then we started flying them. And the but everyone had a hand in that. The Navy was part of it, the Air Force, the Tactical Air Command, SAC, of course, all your intelligence agencies. These people, now we refer to them as the customer. You really never knew just exactly who you were
working for, yes.
But all the agencies, it depends on the project.
Of course, you've heard the stories of alien spacecraft there, extraterrestrial bodies, live ETs.
Oh, yeah.
Did you ever see anything strange out there, TD?
We were the strange ones. I can shed a little bit of light on it. I can't answer all your questions. Obviously, there were sightings and stuff that we can't explain. But I'll give you an example. I think one of the reasons for the people believe there's something there, that for about almost 30 years, no one knew that base was there. And then they woke up one morning and realized we've had a base there all this time. And so it made my imagination go wild. But they were seeing stuff. And the it started with the U-2. We were, we didn't paint the plane or anything. It was silver. And we flying all over the country as we were developing it and started getting all these sightings. And we, of course, we didn't want to be seen because it's supposed to be a secret project. So we painted the U-2, and just the weight of the paint lowered the altitude capability by 1,500 feet.
My gosh, you painted it black, didn't you?
Yeah, painted it black.
Yeah.
And that didn't work. So, but then we started flying the A-12. Now, the A-12 was a plane that flew at 90,000 feet at 2,200 miles an hour, which is faster than a rifle bullet. And we flew 2,850 missions out of Groom Lake between 1962 and 1968. And a lot of these were sighted. The people would see them, but the sun was shining just right, and it's up there twice as high as the ordinary airliner.
17, 18 miles up there almost.
Yeah, 17, yeah.
Holy.
And they would see them. It was a legitimate UFO sighting. And, we're just flying those things every day. And Project Blue Book was going on at that time with the Air Force, and they would investigate these sightings, but this was a very, very top secret program. And if the investigator got too close to learning something about it, he would run up against this security wall, and they'd say, "Whoa, stop right here. Don't go any further. Mm-hmm. This is a secret project. Make up a story and go home."
So you're saying there were no live ETs on the
nothing
base?
Like nothing like that, no. Absolutely
as far
not.
As
everything
you're
was directed at that time. You know, we were in the race to the moon, and was race the Vietnam War was going on, and everything was concentrating on our enemies. So we, you know, really was in a bad shape with Russia at that time. We really expected to go to war.
Yeah, that's true too. Did you have the run of the whole place, or were there areas that they would not let you in?
There was areas that it depended on who you were. For example, it was a need-to-know basis. Everything was compartmentalized. And like my group, there's 23 of us, and we worked out basically out of the same building. We all had different specialties. And once we got there, we didn't necessarily know what the other was doing. You know, you knew basically if he was operating a radar or something, but you didn't know who he's doing it for or this sort of thing. It was strictly a need-to-know, but...
Yeah.
But like the Air Force people that was there with the Osh cart, they weren't even allowed in our building because
Jeez.
We were doing things with the MiGs and the early days of stealth.
So if something strange was going on, there is that possibility you didn't know what was happening there.
Yeah, the details. You knew the mostly what was going on. You knew who was coming out there, and you see them in the mess hall and the you had a general idea, but you didn't know the details, and you didn't ask.
We've heard rumors that the military has been planning in the event of an alien invasion or that they could stage one. Did you guys ever hear anything about that?
Not then, no. No, this is, I've been hearing the same thing that's been talking here just lately, but that wasn't even anything on our mind at that time, absolutely.
Are they still using Area 51 as much as they did before?
Oh, yeah, much more. It's very extensive. And one thing you'll note about it, George, is things don't stay secret out there for 20, 30, 40 years like it did with us. You know, we didn't have computers back then. Everything was slide rule. And
oh, that's right.
It's just a different world that we lived in at that time. But now, you know, like the Predator and the Reaper, we knew about them right away, the Polecat. They release these things just about the minute they go operational, we know about it. But like the A-12, they kept it secret. We flew the first flight in 62, and they didn't declassify the existence of the plane till 91, and they let us start talking about it in 2007.
All right, let's go to some calls here. First-time caller, we've got Chris in Detroit. Hey, Chris, welcome to the show.
One thing you'll note about it, George, is things don't stay secret out there for 20, 30, 40 years like it did for us. You know, we didn't have computers back then. Everything was slide rule, and
you're really muffled up there, Chris, but we'll take another call. Paul in Grand Rapids, you're up with us. Hey, Paul.
Good evening, George. Thank you for taking my call. You've had a guest, a gentleman named Dale Brown, who's wrote many novels for mainly the last 15 years, mainly one's called Dreamland. A lot of his novels are depicted from that Area 51. And my question to your guest, very simply, is if he's familiar with the author, and if he is, he's ever helped him on any of his novels, or if he's also listened to or read his books, is anything that he's written kind of true, but in the future, things that they're actually working on out there?
A lot of Dale Brown's, I like his books, by the way. Personally, I've never helped him. It's not uncommon, though, for the authors like him to get technical assistance, maybe not, you know, out at the area itself, but the historians are good about working with them, and as long as they're, you know, doing a good job of what their intent and all, they do get help. It won't be, you know, deeply classified stuff, but just a general concept. The Air Force and the agency and all of them are pretty obliging on that.
TD, how far advanced are they in terms of technology, that once we know about it, 10 years, 20 years ahead?
Who are you talking about, George?
Our government.
Oh, yeah. Oh, there's no telling. We are so far advanced over any of our other nations that it's just, I don't know details. But, you know, for example, I think you got an example of something that came out of Area 51 that we just learned about was the helicopter that crashed in
Pakistan.
Pakistan. And that's an example of what they're doing out there. It's, you know, platforms and surveillance and the technology. It just blows your mind how advanced they have come since we were there. Because we were using slide rules and you know, the A-12 is still the fastest and highest flying plane in the world and probably always will be. And the SR-71 holds the records. But the only reason is it's because we didn't exist until many years later. We were still top secret, but the SR-71 was a lot slower and flew 5,000 feet lower than the A-12 did.
Does Russia, does China have the equivalent of an Area 51 out there?
Yeah, both of them do.
They do. They've got top scientists there and everything else.
Yeah, yeah, they're way behind us, but they do the same thing we did. Like we tore the MiGs down to see what made them, you know, why they were whacking us so bad in the Vietnam, and they've done the same thing to us. We, I think Iran got some of our F. Let's see, which ones was that?
F-4,
I don't remember which plane. F-15, I think it was. But anyway, they immediately let the Russians have it so they could tear it apart and see what we were doing.
No secrets.
No secrets.
Let's go to Scott, Appleton, Wisconsin, east of the Rockies. Hey, Scott, go ahead.
Thank you, George, for taking my call again. I've talked with you several times in the past, but I wanted to ask your guest. I was a seventh grader in 1965, and I got Wright Patterson Air Force Base about Project Blue Book, and I got a sample questionnaire about a UFO sighting. And I actually, my step grandfather, one of my younger sisters, and I had set up a telescope and I tried. Anyways, I filled out the questionnaire and sent it to Wright Patterson Air Force Base in probably December of 1965. And I was wondering, I went into the military later on, and I'm wondering if some of that didn't filter down to my superiors and that. And I'm wondering if your guest knows why it's taken so long for this stuff to come out.
A lot of it, there's a lot of it that really didn't happen. I don't know the answer to your question because I'm sure there's stuff that has happened that we'll never know about. And, right. And I wouldn't know either because, you know, the old need to know theory because it's, you just don't know everything. And a lot of time it's pretty good. Sightings and stuff, I don't really have an explanation for some of the sightings. I know there's been some that's been unexplained, but being in the aerospace business, you know, I know that the different companies compete with each other for contracts. Like, example would be the A-12. It was put up for competition, and the agency required that it be a stealth plane. And very few people know that was our very first stealth plane, but because it's so secret, they didn't know this. But anyway, that was one of the requirements. But their competition was doing the same thing, and they have to test these things before they can bid on the contract and compete with the with each other. So I think a lot of the sightings would be maybe Boeing up in Washington or someplace is testing out some prototype that they tended to put up against Lockheed down in Southern California. And it'd be secrets because they're keeping them secret from their competitors.
How many years out, TD, do you think technology would be? For example, things they're working on there right now, when would it be used? 10 years from now? 5 years from now? What do you think?
I think a lot quicker. I think we're using stuff. I think the first Iraq war brought things onto the table a lot faster because, you know, we deployed the Patriot missiles, and they weren't ready to be deployed yet. They were still in the testing stage. And so I think we're seeing our technology has advanced so much that we don't have to go through all of these flights and stuff like we did in the old days. You know, we spent several years getting all the bugs out of the A-12. The U-2 wasn't so bad, but the A-12 was a revolutionary plane, and it took us forever to get all the wrinkles out of it. And Now you got computers and experience. They can go back and model, because a lot of the stuff, I'll give you some examples. You know, I worked on the X-15 project before I went to the area. Mm-hmm. And the everything that we sent to the moon, we tested first in the X-15. It was just a vehicle, a means of checking out a new hydraulic system or guided system, the navigation. Same thing with the lifting bodies. That became the space shuttle. So everything that we've got now, we went through a development stage here in Nevada. And that, and that's one thing about Nevada that very few people know. We made 8 astronauts shortly after Alan Shepard in the X-15. And that's some history that people just don't know about. It's not that it's secret. It's just never been told.
Was Yeager ever out there?
No. Yeager, he was Air Force. Yeager didn't like NASA or Navy pilots. If you weren't an Air Force pilot, you weren't a pilot.
Roland in Sacramento, California. Go ahead, Roland.
Hi. My question was, if he's aware of the Bob Lazar story, and based on what Bob Lazar says he did, like as far as being at the cafeteria and how you paid for food and what he's seen and who he was in contact with, if Bob Lazar was really there, or if Bob Lazar, was just telling a tale. And also, what was Bob Lazar and I can't remember the other man that was...
Dan Burrish.
And Lear. What were they watching?
John Lear as well. Okay, first of all, did you ever run into a guy named Bob Lazar out there?
No, he never was out there. His stories just don't hold up at all.
Darn.
And the first thing you said there was him paying for his lunch. We didn't have to pay for our lunch.
Right.
But
if he was working there, would you know it for sure?
We would have known if he was on the base, because he would have flown up. You would have seen it. Just wasn't that large at that time. There just wasn't that many people. And you'd see it. You saw all the same faces every day. And then, in the Roadrunners, we've got the original security guards that was hired by the CIA. They hired a group out of Pennsylvania. They all came from the same little repressed area. There's all old farm boys, like a good cold beer, and that's who they hired for the guards. And they stayed in Nevada, in Las Vegas, actually. They retired, the biggest part of them. And they would know, so I've got access to people like that, and they just laugh when something like the Lazar thing comes up.
Did women work on the base at all?
No. We had one woman that out there at that time. Now, they do now, of course.
Okay.
But back then, no. We had Bitzels with the CIA. He brought his administrative assistant down one night. She spent one night there, and that was the only woman that was ever out there during our era. We never saw any women.
But you know for a fact, no underground base there or anything like that?
No, nothing like that. We were all over the base in that sense. And it just wasn't anything there. It would have been impossible. You look at the photos and stuff of the buildings back then. It was so primitive. And keep in mind, it was monitored very heavily by the Soviet Union in particular. They had satellites over us all the time, which just really gave us fits, because they keep us pinned down, unable to do something for weeks on end at times.
Well, that's true. Okay, well, thank you, TD. And to know more about Area 51, there's a program that's going to be Sunday night at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, 10 p.m. Pacific Time, this Sunday, called Area 51 Declassified on the National Geographic Channel. And if you want to know more about 50 scientists, pilots, and engineers who were interviewed, insiders, about their views of Area 51, it should be a good thing to see. I'll be back in a moment with Richard Sauter on Coast to Coast AM.